Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Two massive beams of light reach high into the New York City sky this evening in tribute to the thousands who died there 6 months ago today. And around the world, people are remembering. Tonight, we'll check in with a few, and with you, to see how we're all faring 6 months on. First, on September 11th, New York's Port Authority Police Department lost 37 members. That's the largest loss of life in a single day by any police department in American history. NPR's Chris Arnold has been following their story. Earlier, I asked him about these unsung heroes and their connection to the World Trade Center.
Yeah, the Port Authority Police, you know, there is no PAPD blue, you know, kind of show or anything like that. I mean, everybody's heard of FDNY and NYPD, but the World Trade Center was actually policed by the Port Authority, which runs all of the bridges, tunnels, airports, and the World Trade Center. And
why the World Trade Center? We understand the port-related elements, but why the World Trade Center?
Well, I think it's a long-involved story that probably isn't worth going into, but there was a big development project that happened in Lower Manhattan, and one way or another, the Port Authority ended up kind of in charge of the whole thing.
And so they were the cops on the beat at the World Trade Center on September 11th and before.
Right. Well, at the World Trade Center, but the World Trade Center was kind of the crown jewel of the Port Authority. So when the plane struck the buildings, hundreds of officers from around the city, from Kennedy, New Jersey, all of the tunnels, the bridges, they just converged on the building and ran in and started getting people out. They saved thousands of people's lives, and they're kind of an unheralded, you know, group of officers because it's an obscure department, but it's also a very small department. There's only 1,200 officers in it, and a lot of these guys you talk to, they knew not five, you know, guys. They knew 10, they knew 20, they knew 35 of the 37 officers who were killed, and they've just been torn apart by this, and they're down there every day, a lot of them working still for 6 months now, digging in the rubble.
75 Port Authority employees in total died on September 11th, about half of them civilians. Were there Port Authority offices at the World Trade Center?
There were Port Authority offices, but it's interesting, the police, which I've really spent more time covering the police department, I think it was all but one of the cops responded. It was not that they were just in the building and it fell on them. I mean, they raced from all over the city, ran into those buildings, and were coming from all over the city.
And having policed them, they must have known them most intimately when it came to evacuation paths and all the rest.
Yeah, they did. And actually, I interviewed a police officer who was underneath the building that didn't fall first. I believe that was building one. I believe building two
That's right.
fell first. And he was down there and got blown across the concourse, the mall area, and is knocked into a wall, got the wind knocked out of him, had concrete in his ears and his eyes. Turns on his flashlight. He's still alive, and it's so smoky he can't even see his flashlight. But he starts calling out to anybody else who might be down there. And he doesn't know how many people he rescued, but because he knew the basement so well, he felt along the walls with a string of people. They held onto his shirt, held onto the next guy's shirt, the next guy's shirt, led them down into the subway, you know, through this kind of labyrinth, and brought them up onto the street before that second building fell. And he was kind of blinded by concrete and couldn't see. He's got no idea how many people he saved, but there's a lot of examples of that, of these guys really knew the buildings well and rushed in there.
In his case, pulling them out of the below-ground portion of the World Trade Center, were Port Authority police also headed up into the towers to rescue people?
Sure, yeah. And just a few weeks ago, they found Kathy Mazza, who is a police captain, who was there with four I believe, four or five other Port Authority officers, and they had they'd rushed up into the upper levels of the building and had made it from the place that they found them in the rubble. Looks like they'd made it to the lobby, and they had a woman in a rescue chair, and they were rushing out of the lobby when the building came down on them.
During the period of clearing away the destruction and rubble at the World Trade Center, have the Port Authority police continued to have a special role?
Well, the most special part of their role now is that they're just there all the time. The fire department and the police department have been having guys go there in shifts. You know, they'll be there for a month on duty, and then they'll bring in some other guys. The Port Authority, I think, in part because they were so intimately involved with the buildings and knew so many people who died, they got on a schedule where it's been the same guys down there for 6 months. And, you know, I don't know what that does to somebody. It's pretty gruesome, the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And there's concern now. I mean, they're all getting counseling and they're trying to stay on top of it. But, you know, what's that going to do to these guys?
You've been talking with them, hearing their stories right there at the disaster site. What are you hearing in their voices and words and stories 6 months after the attack?
You know, it's interesting. The first couple of months, everybody, I mean, the reporters, the firemen, the cops, I mean, everybody had tears in their eyes. It was just heart-wrenching. You know, you go down there and they just knew so many people who they really cared about. Again, this is, you know, it's a department that's the size of a high school. You know, I mean, they knew everybody. They were there for 15 years and 20 years, and they really, really knew and cared about each other, a lot of these guys. Now, you know, it's a little bit further back. I mean, it's been a while. People are moving on. I mean, you know, somebody said the other day, you know, I can hear a bird sing or feel the sun come out, you know, and it's they're not all consumed by it. Something that a guy was just talking to a few days ago down there, the anger is coming out for him. I mean, he says he can't focus on it because he's getting so angry, you know, over this whole thing.
We talked to a survivor on Friday night who said, in fact, it's getting harder, not easier, that the Novocaine of the shock of the incident is wearing off. Do you see that in the Port Authority police in New York?
Well, it's a concern. I mean, everybody talks about studies that were done on Oklahoma City, and it's kind of the general wisdom is that it takes a while for the deepest depression to set in, that it's, you know, when you have all of the support and everybody reaching out to you and, you know, kind of keeping you going, and there's that adrenaline and shock. And, you know, what happened 6 months later, and I believe in Oklahoma City, they saw more cases of alcoholism and drug abuse and other, you know, people start to fall apart more, you know, when time goes on. So absolutely. I mean, I haven't, you know, firsthand seen anybody completely come apart, but it's something that the sergeant I was talking to a few days ago down there says, I'm worried about my men. You know, they don't want to have that happen.
Chris Arnold is a reporter for NPR. Two beams of light tonight, where thousands fell. We're 6 months on, and the world still struggles to fathom the unfathomable. Four planes hijacked, huge buildings crumpled, thousands, and American innocence gone. Last September, the headlines told us we'd never feel the same again. The world would never be the same again. And this evening, we're asking, how do you feel? What are you thinking? Is our world where you thought it would be 6 months on? Are we headed in the right direction? We want to hear from you. Give us a call tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This evening, we're revisiting some very special people from the earliest days of this show's life. In the weeks and months immediately following September 11th, many of you shared your intimate thoughts and feelings with us in on-air radio diaries. Tonight, we're checking back with our diarists and checking in with you. We'll hear from five on-point diarists tonight about their thoughts then and now. But first, I'm joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Evening, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jack, we're going to hear from a lot of people tonight, but kick us off. What's struck you about these 6 months? What expectations met or defied?
Well, just one, I suppose, small thing. I would never have expected after September 11th that the White House political advisor, Director Karl Rove, would give a speech to a conservative group saying that in this year's congressional campaigns, the GOP is going to politicize the war. And instrumental to that design, I would never have expected that ads would be taken out against Tim Johnson, who's running for re-election in the Senate in South Dakota, ads attacking his loyalty for not supporting the president on an economic stimulus bill that would have given hundreds of millions of dollars to the likes of Enron. Mm-hmm. Of course, Tim Johnson, it turns out, has a son serving in Afghanistan. And I would never in my wildest imagination of the McCarthyite right have imagined that the Senate Majority Leader, Tom Daschle, would be attacked in ads that liken him to Saddam Hussein for not supporting that original stimulus bill. So that, to me, is the biggest political shock and moral shock, too.
The loss of unity, the politicization, and the politicization of language very quickly.
Yeah, and there's been a kind of toughening and coarsening of language, and even to express doubts and thoughts is kind of a manifestation of disloyalty. There's been a militarization of thought, and I think it's dangerous.
A lot of turf out of bounds. We have a lot of people to hear from tonight. Our callers, of course, most welcome of all. How has your life changed? How hasn't it changed since 9/11? What changes did you expect in the weeks after 9/11, globally, nationally? And personally, how does it compare with what's really going on with you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jack, we're going to check back in with Cami Patrizio. She's a teacher at the 12th Street Academy in Manhattan. She has junior high school students. It's an alternative school. The kids come from tough circumstances. She lives in Staten Island, so she takes the ferry every day, and she sees and walks by that World Trade Center site. On September 21st, we ran a radio diary from Cami Patrizio. Let's listen, and then we'll talk with her today.
When our school director came into my classroom at 10:30 a.m. on September 11th, I was in the middle of a math lesson with my eighth graders. She told me, "We've been attacked. The World Trade Center is a pile of rubble. The Pentagon has been hit. We think there are going to be more. We don't know who did it. Parents are coming in to pick up their children. Let them go." I nodded, slack-jawed, turned to the unaware class, and continued with my lesson. 15 minutes later, halfway through a sentence, the magnitude of the event registered in the recesses of my brain. I shut down mentally. "That's all for today," I said to the class, their confused faces blithely unaware of the morning's events. I stepped into the hallway and flagged down our dean of students. "Do you want me to tell them?" I asked, and was glad when she told me that she would be visiting each classroom during the next period to deliver the news. I didn't know what I would say to them. How do you tell a group of 13-year-olds from New York City that unknown assailants had destroyed their city's two largest buildings? The idea of the World Trade Center lying in ruins evaded my comprehension. What would it mean to them? Their words and artwork sing of their search for peace. Pictures of planes embedded in flame-engulfed buildings and bodies falling from the sky punctuate our school's memorial wall. I marvel, incredulous at their desire to move forward and make change, inspired by their capacity to care in the face of such tremendous grieving. "To the victims of the World Trade Center," wrote one student, "rest in peace. We will not forget you. We love you."
Cami Patrizio on September 21st, sharing a radio diary with our listeners. We're joined now on March 11th by Cami Patrizio from New York. Good evening. Welcome, Cami.
Hi. How are you?
We're well. Thanks so much for coming back on to talk with us about these last 6 months. Cami, how has it unfolded? Has it unfolded like you thought? There was so much emotion then. We could hear it in your voice, in the voices, no doubt, of your students. How do things look to you today compared to what you expected?
That's a difficult question to answer because at that point in time, I had no idea of what to expect. Personally, for me, it's meant really reassessing my priorities. I love my career. I love my school. I love the people that I work with, and I love our students so much. But I've definitely decided to take more time, to spend time with the people in my life who mean the most to me, with my family and with my friends. So that's been one huge change, which I don't know that I was necessarily expecting.
The turn to family. Yeah. You live in the environment of the World Trade Centers where they were tonight. The towers of light, the tribute of light is up there. Have you seen it?
I stepped outside this evening about half an hour ago to see if I could see it yet, and I wasn't able to. Yeah.
Are you looking forward to seeing that sort of ghostly image of what was there so materially 6 months and one day ago?
I have to be honest, I'm really not. I hear people say that they're moving on, and I've marveled at people's abilities to be so strong, or at least ostensibly so strong about all of this, and it still hurts. Going by the site as often as I do, every time I go by, it still brings tears to my eyes, and it's still really painful. And just the thought of seeing those hollow specters this evening as I'm driving out of town is not something I'm really looking forward to. It's still too real and far too close.
And your students, how are they handling the memory of the 11th? Have they moved on? Are they still tangled up in it?
They grieve in different ways, just like we do. This morning, our school director had us together in a full school community meeting, and she stopped us at the moment that the first plane had hit and said, you know, we're going to have a moment of silence. And I looked around over the school, and our children are really energetic, and I was amazed at how many of them were sitting there with their eyes closed and really intently thinking about what happened then and what that meant for all of us today, many of them crying. It was really powerful.
They weren't taking it lightly.
No, they weren't.
Kimberly, we have to take a short break. Can you stay with us for a minute?
I would love to, thanks.
We're talking about 9/11, 6 months on. What changes did you expect in the weeks after 9/11, globally, nationally, and personally? And what is actually coming to pass? What hasn't happened that you expected to happen? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the country's response, about our personal responses, 6 months on to 9/11. On September 20th, were you ready to reshape your life, start fresh, live differently? Have you done it? Have you not done it? What do you make of the country's response to 9/11 and of your own response? We're talking right now with Cami Patrizio. She teaches in Manhattan. She offered us a radio diary back in September, and today she's still with the junior high school students who are dealing with that, and she's still, like the rest of us, is watching the country's response. Cami, take it up to the national level for just a minute. What do you think of the way the country as a whole has responded to this terrible shock?
You know, what's been incredibly interesting for me has been watching the way that my students interpret the things that they see in the media. I'll hear them in the hallways, and they'll be saying things like, you have anthrax. It's a new joke or a new...
What's it mean when they say it?
It's a bad thing. It's a negative thing, but they don't fully understand it. They know that it's intensely bad, but they don't know exactly what it means. And just the other day, this really struck me. One of my students said, did you hear that there's a nuclear weapon in New York, and they weren't telling us about it, but it's here, in response to the reports last week from the Time magazine.
Was it a joke? Was it serious?
No, it was very serious, and it was that they weren't fully grasping the meaning of what was actually going on. They were getting bits and pieces.
So you see these elements of danger having really become part of the fabric of your students' life?
Yes, absolutely.
And how about your personal life, Cami? Have you made changes? Are you contemplating changes?
I am definitely contemplating changes in a way that I was not contemplating them back in early September.
Such as?
A native New Yorker and certainly not a city person by any wild stretch. Mm-hmm. I had never intended to make a life here, but will certainly be leaving the city much sooner than I had anticipated.
So you're thinking about leaving the city, leaving your job?
Yeah.
Why?
I am. To be closer to those people that I love mm-hmm. the most, because it really, life is so short and so incredibly fragile, as evidenced by what happened on the 11th. And with my time on this planet, I want to spend it with those people.
Cami, is there also an element of disenchantment with the city there? Is there something about being near the scar that is hard for you?
Absolutely. It hits me every time I take the ferry over to Staten Island and I look back at the skyline. And there's a police presence here that I don't remember seeing before, you know, and there are streets that are occasionally blocked off and exits that you can't use. And it's a reminder. It's a painful reminder, and it's a frightening reminder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cami Patrizio, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us last fall and for sharing them with us again tonight.
Thank you so much for asking.
Jack Beatty, there you hear one story. Classrooms still abuzz with anthrax and now nukes and a Manhattan teacher thinking of moving on.
Yeah, and she got the word just the way the president did. He was teaching a lesson in front of a class, too. And just like mm-hmm. Ms. Patrizio, he had to swallow hard and keep going with his lesson. Quite a moment.
Yeah. We're joined now by Margaret Kenta. Margaret's an American woman living in Germany, was there on 9/11, and felt a powerful yearning to be back in the United States. Before we turn to her, let's turn to her radio diary from October 11th, Margaret Kenta.
What I think most about these days is how to get home, to find a way back across the Atlantic to confront this new war on my soil. When I first came to Germany almost a year ago, I thought the winter fog and fields of mud would be the hardest part. Then came September, and like a switch, the sun was gone, the fog returned, the soil turned soft. And I remembered, railed against what was to come. What came was the 11th, and now when I wake to the fog, I say a prayer of thanks, hoping the layer of gray will make me invisible to the Luftwaffe flying their ear-splitting scrambles over my roof. I used to joke that my move abroad had turned me expat. The 11th taught me that I'm more American than I'd ever let myself know. It seems naive to have taken so much for granted. I want to wear my own clothes and fly my own flag without thinking of State Department advisories. I want to speak my language, not only the words, but all the rest that goes with it. Some locals I know have said how lucky I am. I could have been there, but they're greatly mistaken. For all of my soul, it's where I already am. The president said we should get back to normal. So I think of the ocean that seems more like a wall than infinite beads of water. And I plan how to cross it so I can get back. Because what I want most is to be home.
Margaret Kenta, an American living in Germany, on October 11th, wanting most to be home. Margaret Kenta joins us now. Good evening and welcome, Margaret Kenta.
Hello, how are you?
We're well. Thanks so much for being with us. Margaret Kenta, you have spent these last 6 months with a lot on your plate, but tell us first about the experience of being an American as the fall and the war on terror unfolded into winter. How's it been?
It's been rather difficult, I think, as I still have the feeling that I am not as connected as I would want to be. I'm not having the kind of information that I would want to be and want to have, and I feel all the more greatly that I am very far from home.
How about the attitude of the Germans around you toward the American war effort? Have you felt support? Have you felt alienation? How's it look?
Personally, there's empathy for what happened, but it's not the same emotion that I have experienced having it happen on home territory and in a skyline that I'm very familiar with. Mm-hmm. And certainly there has been support personally.
Margaret, we know that last fall for all of us, we were, for as Jack Beatty said earlier, we were united for some days or weeks in a national crisis, in a global crisis. But our personal lives have a way of coming back into the foreground, into prominence. Tell us about your life since that day and how the personal came to loom larger.
I had been greatly affected by the 11th, as I wrote. And I had been thinking to come home for quite some time, but I had been trying to be very logical about it and step by step. After the 11th, when the first few weeks of the initial shock was coming a little bit finished, I simply put that aside and I said the most important thing is simply to get home and stop being logical. Unfortunately, as I was packing to come, I was diagnosed with cancer, and this has been difficult now to come home because that happened so quickly. Now I'm in treatment and
unable to come home, I guess, because of that, Margaret.
Well, it happened so quickly. I was not able to make the transition before the hospitals took over.
You know, in every great time of public calamity, there's always this tension between the urgency of the public calamity and the inevitable urgency, in your case, keen urgency. And we're sorry for your cancer. But how do you juggle those things in your mind? Does the immediate medical issue blot out the global issue? Do they somehow exist side by side?
I think they are very taking up similar spaces in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the 11th has in no way left me, I find myself thinking about it quite a bit, it's still and having a great impact on my daily life. However, of course, I just logistically I must deal with the other
Right. The first things first, the facts of health and moving toward health. Margaret, how about the American response overall? Do you feel satisfied with it? Is it taking the country, the world, in the direction you'd like to see it going?
I was very pleased and heartened when the coalition was put together, and feeling that this was simply a necessary thing. And I only hope now that it stays together. I'm afraid that I crave more news sources than I'm able to get. So I'm basically, I think, having the same headlines over and over without having very much in-depth to go on that I would have if I was if I happened to be in the States right now.
Margaret Kenta in Germany, our prayers are with you with your cancer and your treatment. We hope it's splendidly successful, and we thank you for sharing with us last fall and again tonight.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beattie, let's turn to the phones. People want to join us in this conversation. Mordi is on the line. Welcome, Mordi. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I don't want to take away from the personal anguish of either people who survived it or the people who lived through it in the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, my first response was really fury.
Yeah.
I was furious at the perpetrators. I was furious at our own government for basically sticking its head in the sand and letting it happen.
How many of us shared that sentiment, that just cold fury?
Because, you know, they blew up an American ship. They blew up sovereign U.S. territory in Nigeria and Tanzania.
The embassies. Mm-hmm.
They tried to blow up the World Trade Center as long as 9 years ago. They caught a bomber in Brookline, and it's not Brookline, I apologize, in Brooklyn, who was within days of trying to blow up the subway.
And Mordi, how's your flame of outrage tonight, 6 months later?
It hasn't changed one iota. I think that the Bush administration has made a complete mess of this thing.
You do, in its military response, you don't like...
No, I think the military response is great. I have the utmost respect for the American military. I have the utmost respect for the people who are conducting the war.
So you see the botch-up before 9/11 or
no,
since?
The botch-up is political.
Mm-hmm.
The botch-up is political.
How so, in your eyes?
What kind of stupidity is it to talk about going into Iraq at this point? What kind of stupidity is it not to finish stage one and to be talking publicly about stage five?
What's the impulse you think is driving those moves that you don't like?
The impulse?
Yeah.
I think the only impulse that drives this administration is it's the lobbyists and the votes. I don't think they can see beyond the people who give them money, and I don't think that they can see beyond trying to win the next election.
Mordi, thanks very much for your call. Let's turn to another call. Sky is on the line. Welcome, Sky. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Well, I'm very concerned about the civil liberties that seem to be being ignored in the name of safety. And my group of people, from my perspective, I'm seeing so many so concerned. And in hearing a lot of the calls, I know how important it is to deal with the pain and the suffering. But in that, those of us who are basically not so connected to that, it seems like there needs to be more people thinking and talking about these civil liberties that are being used and taken away.
Are you feeling a vacuum of debate around that loss?
Yes, absolutely.
Sky?
And precisely because there seems to be a fear on a lot of people's parts to stand up and have some kind of criticism of the processes that are being used. And I concern deeply about that. I'm very concerned about how fast people are willing to give up their freedoms and not really understand how these freedoms can be eroded so quickly just because we're afraid. And fear is obviously always operative, but one opportunity that it seems is important is that our leaders really can take this opportunity to call out the best in people, to raise to the highest values, the widest possibilities, and to begin to see ways to approach this problem other than just with force.
Mm-hmm. Sky, are you even able to keep track of exactly what civil liberties you've lost?
Well, I'm more concerned about the ones that I see when precedents are set for instance, you know, when the habeas corpus is taken away, even for people who are not American citizens, it sets a precedent, and it says to the rest of the world, we don't even believe our own values anymore. If we can throw them away so easily, for whatever reason, the democracy stands because people stay solid in understanding what that democracy is about and how it really works. And if we start giving up one principle because it doesn't fit us to do so on that day, we have now threatened my own principle when it comes to me.
Scott, you make the point loud and clear, and we thank you for calling in with it. We want to turn, before the next break, to one more diary that we heard on October 17th, this one from Ewan McDougall. He's a student at Yale, enrolled in the Platoon Leaders Program of the U.S. Marines, an ROTC program. Here's an excerpt from his diary then.
About this time, 1 year ago, I decided to join the United States Marine Corps. I spent 6 weeks this past summer in Quantico, Virginia, at Officer Candidate School, undergoing the first phase of training. I joined for two reasons: to serve my country and to seek self-improvement in ways I never could at Yale. As I approach manhood and full citizenship, I have begun to consider my patriotic duty. How can I express my gratitude and give back to the country that has given me so much? I like America, I like the Yale experience, and I like being here, debating and discussing in an open forum like this. On September 11th, all of that was attacked, and yet it can only exist in the first place because, to stand up and defend our way of life, we have patriots. I have decided to be one, rather than hope for a free ride or expect someone else to protect me. I can think of no higher calling than joining the Marines. Since September 11th, a day I could never have envisioned a year ago, concerned family and friends have asked me, "What does this mean for you? Aren't you afraid you'll be sent off to war?" And again, I find the question misguided. I respond that I've never been prouder of my decision. Indeed, it is exactly for situations like this that I felt compelled to join. And yes, I am afraid. But it is a fear that, far from scaring me into passivity, pacifism, or cowardice, calls instead for activity, courage, and patriotism. My country needs me, and it needs each one of you, too.
Ewan McDougall, a Marine ROTC member, sharing his thoughts with us last October. He's with us this evening. Good evening. Welcome, Ewan McDougall.
Hi, how are you?
We're well. Thanks for being with us. Ewan, since you shared that with us, the U.S. military has gone ever more into action. Just the last week and a half, you've seen Operation Anaconda, very fierce fighting in the mountains of Afghanistan. You are on a track that may well lead you into that kind of combat in this open-ended war on terror. How do you feel about that?
I stick by the courage of my convictions as ever. I decided to join the Marines before September 11th, and the reasons that compelled me to join, namely service to the country and self-improvement, are still there. And I believe even more strongly in it now, because I think terrorism still poses a threat. History shows that you can't just retaliate against terrorism or intimidate it, but that it must be eliminated or it will strike back. So treating it as a war is the right response, and we can't stop until the terrorists have been eradicated.
Ewan, how much in step or out of step with your fellow students on the Yale campus do you feel with this view?
Well, this is an Ivy League campus, and there are a lot of opinionated people around, and a lot of people respect what I do, but a lot of people don't. And I think the negativity that I get comes from people who just have a very different understanding of international affairs and the forces that motivate people. And while I disagree with those people, I think it's good that they think what they think and that I think what I think, because I think differences like that are crucial to a healthy democracy.
And you and one of our callers just before you came on said she was worried about an erosion of civil liberties since September 11th. When you get into the Marines and you're out there fighting, are you simultaneously watching what it is exactly at home that you're fighting for? Do you expect you will be?
I'm not sure I quite follow.
Well, are you concerned at all about principles being eroded at home while the military is in the field fighting for liberty?
Yeah, I think it's good that while we have a fighting force abroad, we also have people at home sort of being defensive and making sure that we don't go too far in violating civil liberties and things like that.
Ewan McDougall,
for democracy.
Thank you. I'm sorry we got to go for a break. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ewan McDougall is a Yale student and an ROTC Marines member. We're talking about the meaning of 9/11 6 months on and how it's changed for you, how it's ripened. What does it mean to you now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about 9/11 and how we feel about it 6 months on. Do you feel safe again? Does that surprise you if you do? And 6 months after September 11th, are we on the right track? What's made you proud? What's made you cringe in the U.S. response to the terrorist attacks? Are we rising to the challenge? Are you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, in the last three callers and guests we had on, we heard outrage at the attack and U.S. vulnerability. We heard fear for American civil liberties. And we heard a readiness to fight. This seems to kind of describe a profile of many Americans.
Yeah, in all directions.
I think yes. That
the you know, I think that the amalgamating emotion and impact of the attack has worn off, and people are now expressing a range of sentiments that we didn't feel. But it's so strange to me that so little of this has shown up in politics. The collapse of the Democratic Party, to me, is one of the striking events since September 11th. We have Senator Lieberman staying up. We need to take on Iraq. We have Albert Gore. We need to take on Iraq. We even have our own John Kerry, who's immune to any, you know, soft criticism as a war hero, saying, well, we may have to reckon with Iraq. You know, in 1991, 1990, there was a great debate over Iraq. It was one of the wonderful moments in the post-war era when senators got up there and had to define what the national interest was, what a vital interest was. And now, with the collapse of opposition, I'm just terribly afraid that we could make an awful mistake without that debate, without the people understanding the risks.
What do you make of it, Jack? Do you think that the Democratic leaders feel they'll be seen as mamby-pamby if they're not ready to just stand up and go to the guns?
Well, look what happened to Tom Daschle. He made some just, you know, mild comments about, you know, the criteria the Bush administration had laid down for the war and the difference and the distance we had to go before we reached that. Mm-hmm. He was pilloried by the sort of plug uglies in the press, by the Wall Street Journal editorial board, as, you know, practically traitorous. Trent Lott, who, you know, I think almost did call him that. And, of course, he immediately retreated. I mean, This is grim. I mean, we need the debate now because it's not coming from it's been silenced from within the Bush administration. Colin Powell and the State Department about Iraq apparently have been turned down, and now we need to hear it from the other party, and all we get is silence.
Jack, maybe there's an honest consensus that it's time to bite the bullet, to do the hard work, to go after the evil, the bad guys.
Well, if there is, then there's also a consensus not to think about possible consequences. It's a substitution of sort of patriotic elan and for thought.
Let's turn now to Zoe Clark West. Zoe is a young mother in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She joined us last fall. It was September 27th to share with us her thoughts about 9/11 and motherhood and her experience of dealing with a child.
Exactly 1 week after the terrorist attack on the United States, a coworker asked me how my son was doing in the wake of the week's tragic events. For the first time, I realized how well my son was doing and how well, because of him, I was doing. On that fateful Tuesday, my office was shut down, and I rushed to my son's school alongside many worried parents. As I listened to my coworkers, to friends, to people on the radio, many of them seemed to be lost in this no-time land. Their days are made up of news coverage, special reports, little eating, and less sleep. It is as if the larger world has swallowed up their own and sucked the life right out of them. A child, however, will pull you back to the reality of lost shoes, band-aids, underwear jokes, and snacks. For him, with his parents framing and explaining what he saw that day, the world was still contained in the simple idea that sometimes people choose to do very mean things, and we don't know why. But in our family, we don't choose to do mean things, and we are safe, and we love each other. So it is that I am doing well. Well enough, that is, in the wake of so terrible events, that when my son sees that I'm sad, he can hug me and ask me why. And I can tell him that sometimes very sad things happen. And feeling his tender hands on my face, I can let him feel sad with me while in my sorrowing heart a sweetness swells due to the goodness that is his world.
Zoe Clark West on September 27th. Zoe Clark West joins us this evening. Good evening and welcome, Zoe.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us then and now. Zoe, as you listen back and you remember the comfort that you found in September, needing to simplify the meaning of 9/11 for your child to bad people doing bad things. Has that simplicity stayed with you as a comforting factor?
Yes, I don't know that I simplified it quite as bad people doing bad things, but the people choose to do bad things,
yes.
and people also choose to do good things, and mm-hmm. we saw both of that going on that day, mm-hmm. And we've continued to see that, and I think what's been interesting is that now I have to explain to him that I support my country, and sometimes my country chooses to do things I don't agree with, It's complex, even though it's simple, but it has helped me as well to frame it that way.
In September, we can hear the emotion in your voice. You were shocked, like everybody, at the attacks. Do you still feel that shock today, or how do you look back on that?
I still feel shocked, but I think also in framing it for him simply like that, that people get to choose to do. People choose to do bad things and good things. I think I've also thought about it somewhat historically and have realized that people have been choosing to do bad things to each other, since the world began, and was a little bit astonished that we were so surprised that this bad thing happened to us. And of course we were shocked and surprised because something like that had never happened to us in our, not in my generation. But bad things like this have been happening to people in the world, in other places. And so I'm thinking, we were so astonished. But bad things like that happen mm-hmm. in other places all the time.
But we would be immune.
Yeah, I'm a little shocked at our feeling so invulnerable.
And how about your son? 6 years old, I think. How is he processing 9/11? Is he paying any attention to it? Is it on his mind at all?
It comes up occasionally, and in surprising ways and very matter-of-factly. I think it wasn't very soon after September 11th, but we were driving down Storrow Drive, where you can have a really great view of the Hancock Building
in
and
Boston.
He just said
mm-hmm.
matter-of-factly from the back seat of the car, "Oh, an airplane could hit that building." So
Bingo.
Obviously he has processed this.
It's there. Zoe Clarquist, thank you for coming back on with us tonight.
Certainly.
Let's turn to the phone lines. Michael is on the line. Michael, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well, thanks, Michael.
Tom, I'm an Episcopalian priest.
All right.
My parish is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was also born in England, and I chose to become an American citizen.
All right.
I chose to become a citizen because the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of these United States are magnificent documents.
They are. We'll all agree to that. And how are you feeling about it 6 months after 9/11?
Well, I have conflicted feelings. One of my parishioners works for the TK Maxx company. Six of her colleagues were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Another of my members of my church in Cambridge, his best friend was killed. My cousin by marriage is a New York City firefighter. My heart bleeds for those people. I cry for them. I weep for them. But I'm also scared as a liberal. I want us to talk and not fight. I want us to use the United Nations and not bombs. And there are days when I'm scared that if I speak out, some person from Attorney General Ashcroft's office or some other government department will say, "Well, you can't live here anymore because you oppose us. You want to talk. You don't want to fight."
Mm-hmm. Do you feel the impulse to talk, not just among ourselves, not just Americans talking to Americans, but Americans talking with the world? Do you feel a locus of that anywhere in your world, Michael?
Absolutely. I'm always in touch with friends in Europe who just sort of can't understand why we won't listen to them, why we won't let their viewpoint be heard in this country.
Mm-hmm. Michael, I want to get some more calls in. Our time's running short, but we thank you very much for your call and for the reminder that there may be more than a military solution here. Valerie is on the line. Welcome, Valerie. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I'm going to be 24 next week,
okay.
And shortly after September 11th that day or that week, I was talking with my boyfriend, who's going to be 24 tomorrow, and we were saying that we just were so surprised because I remember as a small child up until maybe the age of like 7 being consciously afraid of nuclear war all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just wasn't anymore. And I figured part of that was, you know, you just stop being afraid of things like that when you grow up a little bit. But I think a lot of it was the end of the Cold War, too. And I just...
And now, Valerie?
Now I'm afraid a lot more often, and I never thought I would have to be. It just didn't occur to me that this would ever come back to me. And on vacation a month ago, I met a man from England, and I told him that, and he just couldn't believe that it had, you know, that no one saw this coming or could even imagine that maybe it would be coming.
Mm-hmm. Valerie, we're going to have to go back to one more contributor, but thank you for your call. The holiday from history, as Jack Beatty has often reminded us, is over. In October 28th, we heard from Gail Pryor. She's a soccer mom in Belmont, Massachusetts, a freelance book editor and mother of three boys. Here's what she had to say in October.
Every October, my sons begin making their plans for Halloween. I eavesdrop from the driver's seat to their discussions, to the planning board meetings held in the back of our minivan. Okay, says my 10-year-old. How about this year? We have screaming spiders that drop down on top of people from the trees. Good idea, concurs my 14-year-old. But let's talk about the dummy. Yeah, shouts the 4-year-old. Let's make it all bloody. Kids have their ritual at Halloween. Grown-ups perform their rituals all year long. We watch horror movies. We imagine disaster in the middle of the night. Now, though, the worst things we can imagine have escaped the borders of our minds and become real. So what are my boys learning after September 11th? That there really is truly bad stuff out there, and we can't scare it away with a bloody dummy. What can we do instead? We can face real danger with real courage. We can treat each other with tenderness. We can find ways to laugh at the gallows. And the planning board meetings? They've continued in the back of the minivan. Okay, says my 10-year-old. We still make a dummy, but this time it's an old lady sitting in a rocking chair, and get this, she's reading Playgirl magazine.
Gail Pryor on October 28th. Gail Pryor, good evening and welcome. Thanks
Hi.
For joining us tonight.
Thank you for asking me.
Gail, you talked last fall. You joined us twice. You talked about tenderness, and you talked about in another contribution, an essay on November 28th, about reading, not Playgirl magazine this time. And we see you're raising your kids right there, Gail. But about how reading was helping, was drawing you. You were looking for understanding. You wanted to dive into books and not stop reading until you found the answers.
Right.
Are you still reading? Have you found the answer, Gail Pryor?
No. Yes, I am still reading. And no, I haven't found the answer at all. I found some comfort. The first thing I read, really, I had started long before September 11th, mm-hmm. and I finished it the day after.
That was?
September 12th, which was David McCullough's biography of Sam Adams.
John Adams.
I'm sorry, John Adams.
Sure.
Excuse me. And it was so comforting to read that. It really helped the day afterwards. It helped me to understand the surge of patriotism that I felt that I had never felt like that before.
Because it took you back to the founders.
Yes. It took me back. It crystallized for me that this is a country built on an idea.
And is that still floating you today, Gail Pryor?
Yeah, it is. And it floated me through, you know, all the reading that I did afterwards, trying to understand the origins of the conflict, trying to understand the perspective of people I had not spent very much time thinking about before.
Are you confident those ideals will carry the country through?
Well, they certainly were there and carried us through the intensity of those first few months. I was so proud of the way we faced that every American faced that crisis, and I'm so proud of Americans, and I hope that over the long term, as we sort out this conflict as it plays out, that our government will remain true to that essential American spirit. As it seemed to in the immediate aftermath of the attack, I was proud of all of us. I was proud of people I hadn't voted for
mm-hmm.
in those first few weeks. And now I hope we can hang on to something that did carry us through that. And I don't know about that anymore.
We want to stay proud. Gail Pryor, thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Gail Pryor in Belmont, Massachusetts. Jack Beatty, there you hear it. Americans who want to stay proud. They want to fight for the right thing.
Yeah, and Gail Pryor wanting that emotion to last, that feeling of September 11th.
Let's hope for that. Thanks, Jack.